Devoncast from Radio X.
Elections are looming and party leaders have been in Devon to rally the troops ahead of the county council polls next week. We have not one but two of them on Devoncast today with me, Guy Henderson, and my colleague Bradley Gerrard. Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, was at Sandy Park, the home of the Exeter Chiefs, to meet his team of candidates from across the county. Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, has a reputation for an eye-catching photo opportunity, and he did not disappoint when he met local candidates at the Big Sheep in North Devon. We'll hear from both of them later, but first we have a studio guest.
Indeed we do, Guy. Today we're welcoming Gavin Ellis, the Chief Fire Officer of Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue Service. Like all public services, the fire service has its challenges, with demands rising at a time of financial pressure. That means the fire service is reviewing how it operates, including trying to ensure it can reduce the amount of times it gets called out to non-incidents, and lobbying for extra funding, most notably in relation to its frequent responses to flooding incidents. Mr. Ellis, welcome to Devoncast. You've been atop the county's fire service for just about 2 years now. What's been the biggest challenge in that time?
Good afternoon. So some of the challenges that we've seen, particularly in the time that I've been in the Chief Fire Officer role, is, as you mentioned, around the reducing budget and the funding for the Fire and Rescue Service, not just for Devon and Somerset, but across the whole of England and Wales.
And has it actually been reducing? It's not just that things are things just getting more expensive and therefore it's reducing by proxy?
So it's reducing by proxy. So what we are seeing is, since 2015, the grant that we received from the government has reduced time and time, to the point where our core spending power currently is less than it was in 2015. Of course, we've seen inflationary rises, but on top of that is the overinflated pay awards that come after that, that we then fund straight out of our revenue budget. One of the other challenges that we've seen is for, since 2015, where we used to receive direct funding for capital. So that would be for replacement fire engines, replacement fire stations, for example, that need to be rebuilt. We've had to take that money directly from our revenue budget. So when we set our budget each year and we look at the council tax that the fire authority allow us to set as a preset every single year, we need to take money out of that budget to put into the capital reserve.
So you used to get money entirely from a separate source or in a separate pot for capital, like buying a new fire engine, but now you don't get any of that at all?
We did. So we would have received, we've seen a percentage based on each of the fire service levels, and for us it was circa around about £2 million it would have seen each year directly funded into our capital reserve. Since that stopped, as I say, around about 10 years ago now, we're having to take money out of our revenue budget, which is quite largely dependent on the number of staff that we employ. So our budget is around about 80% of that is to pay for our staff and for pensions and things like that. So we're quite heavily dependent on the budget to make sure that we can remain having the numbers that we have of our firefighters, our officers and support functions to be able to deliver what we need to deliver. So you can see by taking money out for the capital has quite a significant impact for us.
And so presumably that's a really big challenge for you then. So as you said, the biggest cost obviously is people. Does that mean there's pressure on numbers then?
It certainly does. So as we've seen, particularly since 2011 through to 2015, where we've seen the two financial crises, through to now where we're still recovering from that, we have seen our budget reduce over time. We are able to set the preset with the council tax, but we also need to make sure that we're spending that appropriately and wisely, because what we don't want to do is put our communities under pressure by increasing council tax just for the sake of it. So it's really important that we have plans that we have delivered through to the Fire and Rescue Service so that we continue to deliver a fantastic service. This is at the same time when we're seeing our core incidents reduce, so things like house fires and road traffic collisions are the lowest they've been for us, which is fantastic through the prevention work. But what we are seeing is an 18% increase in other incident types. So we are seeing the effects of the climate. We're seeing increased flooding that we're attending, so whether that's through coastal flooding or inland water rescues, but also the wildfires that we're starting to see as well. And we certainly saw that in 2022, where we'd had a dry year and a significant number of wildfires across the country, but also across the southwest. And this year is following a very similar pattern at the moment. And we know that those types of incidents, the numbers are low, but the number of fire appliances and the number of firefighters we need to fight those fires over a long extended period is significant.
I was going to ask that, yeah, because when you think of the fire service conventionally, obviously you think of engines turning up at a residential property, tackling that fire, away they go again. But those instances you've just described, such as wildfires, must be incredibly resource intensive and time intensive as well. So even though there's fewer of them, you're probably spending more money and putting more resources towards those. Is that right?
That certainly is the case. And so particularly for wildfires, we could have anything from what we would call a standard wildfire, anything from between 8 to 15 fire appliances attending those, with large number of firefighters and officers. And also the impact of then making sure that we continue to cover the risk within the service area of where those fire engines have been taken from. So we need to then make cover moves to make sure that those towns and villages are still covered with the fire, the cover that's needed. And that's similar to the flooding as well. So in 2022, we saw the wettest year, but also the hottest year. So a real dichotomy of those types of incidents. And we're seeing that again this year. And again, the flooding, it causes a significant effort to cover, particularly across the geographical areas that we've got of Devon and Somerset. We have such a large spread of geographical area that we need to cover that it can quickly use up quite a significant amount of our resources.
It sounds like a really stupid question, but does it cost more to deal with a fire on the moor or a flooding incident somewhere than the old call-outs, the fires, the house fires, the business fires? Is it more expensive to deal with these environmental kind of issues?
You would say, from a purist perspective, you'd say an incident should cost the same depending on the level of time, but actually it does have a significant impact for us because as Devon and Somerset, we're the largest employer of on-call firefighters within the country. So we have 83 fire stations across Devon and Somerset. Only 12 of those are crewed on a 24/7 basis, which we call whole time. The rest are on-call fire stations. So that is where firefighters have another primary role, another job within the community, and they respond within 5 minutes to the station and take the fire appliance. Now, a standard domestic house fire, you would expect to see the crews arrive and it would be resolved within a couple of hours and then come away. With wildfires and flooding incidents, they could be deployed for significantly longer periods of time. And because of that, we pay what we call an on-call fee to our on-call staff. So we pay them to be available. That costs us a level of fee. But then we also then pay them for the activity type. So when they're being used, we're paying them the same hourly rate as a whole-time firefighter. So the more they're used, the more it costs. And it's very, very difficult to be able to set our budget each year on what we think the likelihood is of them being used, because it's not retrospective, it's forecast.
Now, part of the background to that, your head of finance recently outlined the base case of £13 million funding gap between now and 2030. Does that worry you? And what does it mean for the fire service? And is there anything you can do about that?
Primarily, it does worry me, the funding gap that we have, because my job and the responsibility of the Fire and Rescue Service is to make sure that everybody that lives or visits Devon and Somerset are safe in the activities they undertake, whether that's through the prevention work we do within the homes, whether it's through inspections we do within the built environment, or whether it's through RTC reduction and things like that and other preventative activities when people are coming here on holiday. So it's really important for me that we have the right level of fire cover across the service areas to be able to respond to people's emergencies when they need us. We have seen since 2011, we've saved significant amount of money, in circa £20 million in that time, which is a significant amount of our budget. What it does do, though, unfortunately, it does pass on the pressures to the local communities to be able to fund some of that through council tax precept. And what we are doing is we're currently writing to all of our local MPs to support us with writing to the Treasury, the Home Office, and now the MHCLG to put in additional funding for the Fire and Rescue Service. What we have seen is a reduction across the country of 9,000 whole-time firefighters since before 2014, when the budget started to bite. And as I say, we've seen an increase in 18% of incidents, and we're getting to a point where it's no longer sustainable, and we need to be thinking about how can we make the Fire and Rescue Service sustainable in the future, as our core functions are reducing, as I say, around house fires. But actually, there is an increasing growth and demand on our services around the environmental factors, as I've laid out, but also around mental health related incidents, which is significantly increasing as well.
Because, I mean, your precept is capped at 5%. Is it time to have that conversation with the public and with the government to increase that 5%?
I would certainly like to be able to have those conversations with our communities and with the fire authority to be able to lay that out as well on behalf of our communities. So the increase that we saw this year is roughly equivalent to around about a packet of crisps a week. So from that perspective...
Per person, presumably.
Yeah. So from that perspective, I think if we spoke to our communities, and we regularly do when we go out for consultation each year on the council tax increase, but also around our community risk management plan, when we outline to our communities what we're trying to achieve and what the risks are and how we plan to resource against that, we always get a supportive response from our communities. We also recognise that there has been the cost of living crisis and that we need to make sure that we support our communities in how they respond to that as well. But I think it's vitally important that we have a fire and rescue service that's sustainable, not just for today, but for the future. We saw the outcomes of the fires in Los Angeles and the devastating effect that had on those huge communities. But also when you look at incidents across the country, we've had the Grenfell outcomes. We had the fire in London recently at the airport, which knocked out a significant impact on huge numbers of people. And so I think people think about the fire and rescue service when they need them, as opposed to what we do from a preventative perspective when they don't need us.
In terms of the council tax bit, are all fire services allowed to raise their part of council tax, that word precept, by the same amount, or have some counties been able to raise it by more than Devon and Somerset has?
So across the country, the Fire and Rescue Service has about 6 or 7 different governance models. So it's not a standard governance model. So there are services that are close to us. So if you look at Cornwall, for example, they're a county council governed service. So they're a department within the county council. Now it's down to the county council to decide how they put their precept up, which is a different level. So we've seen our local authorities of Devon and of Somerset that we cover, from the local authority perspective, being able to increase their precept by more than 5%. Fire and Rescue Service was capped at £5 or 5%, whichever was the greatest. For us, it's pretty much the same. Previously, we could only go to 2.99%, but that's done on an annual basis as well, so it's really difficult to try and predict what our budget will be in the next year, because we've only been getting single-year settlements from the government every year for the last 10 years. We're hoping through the comprehensive spending review that we'll have some good news, that we'll have a 3-year settlement, which will give us some certainty about the plans we need to put in place. But that then doesn't allow us to then think about how we raise the council tax precept within those years. So it's really done on a year-by-year basis, and it's based on what the government will allow us to do at that point. We can go out for a consultation with the public to see if they would allow us to increase by more than 5%, but the cost of that pretty much wipes out any of the benefits.
Isn't it in the millions, like £2 million or something?
It would be around between £2 and £2.5 million for us to do that consultation.
For more money?
Yes.
Yep. Which I'm presuming you'd think, and residents might well agree, that that would be ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's really important from our perspective for us as the executive board of the fire service, but also the fire authority members, that we spend every single penny appropriately. And for that, we don't think that would be an appropriate spend of money.
Yeah. You mentioned about the amount of staff that obviously the fire service has and retained and on-call firefighters. In recent years, there's been concern about the number of appliances that are permanently crewed, with the vast majority relying on retained or on-call firefighters, as you said. And those individuals respond to pager alarms and go to the fire stations and then go to the incident. How does the picture look now in terms of fully staffed appliances versus retained ones? You touched upon that, but is there any plan to change it at all?
So currently, we have, as I said, we've got 83 fire stations. We have 112 fire engines. 99 of those are crewed by on-call firefighters, so part-time firefighters. The on-call firefighters in our communities and our whole-time firefighters do a fantastic job, and they're able to provide that operational response as and when we need it. So from an efficient and effective operational response, the on-call is a fantastic model. What we have done, though, we recognise, because of the support that we need from them, was the investment that we made through the increase and change in the availability that we offer and the payment for that. So we, as a fire and rescue service, offer an enhanced payment to our on-call firefighters than of that of the rest of the country. So we recognise the value they offer, but in return, we have one of the highest levels of cover within the country. So our availability for on-call is around about 85%, which is significantly higher than the rest of the country, where some services are seeing their on-call availability at around about 5 or 6%. And so,
wow, that seems like a stark difference in numbers. So can you explain that 85% number? What does that mean, that 85% of firefighters who are on-call members are nearly always available or always respond? Or
yeah, so we always need to have a minimum of 4 firefighters on each fire engine, but we also need to have a couple of skill sets, so a driver and an officer in charge. And for 85% of that time, those fire engines that we have are available to respond.
Does that mean that for 15% of the time they're not then? There's a call gone in and there's no response?
No, so they would be available, but the systems that we have within our control system are able to identify those appliances that are available and are not available on a minute-by-minute basis. So we wouldn't press the button to mobilise an appliance. If it was shown unavailable, it would mobilise the next. But we have a commitment to our communities to be able to respond to all property fires within 10 minutes. So we make sure that our availability is there to make sure we can respond in an appropriate way. So from that perspective, we know that if somebody rings 999, we will offer a fantastic response in a quick fashion to make sure we get there as efficiently and effectively as we can. And I'd also like to say, if I can, that the role of a firefighter whole time is fantastic, really dedicated. We've currently got our whole time recruitment open at the moment, but also for those that are in the on-call system as well, it's a really good way of supporting your local communities, being part of a fantastic organisation and really showing that you have something to give back to your communities and being paid well at the same time of being out and going doing community events, but also responding to those emergencies when people need us.
And so those on-call firefighters, I'm presuming, do they mean that our fire service here in Devon is suitably staffed, or is it understaffed? How would you sort of characterise the staffing levels of the service now?
So from a whole time perspective, we have the numbers that we need to manage that, and we have a really good workforce planning strategy to make sure that we can identify when people are coming for retirement or leaving and be able to replace those. From an on-call perspective, because of the size of the numbers, we employ 2,000 staff. We always have a natural turnover, whether it's people that are retiring or they've done a few years of commitment to their communities and want to move on. And so we have a general ongoing system of recruitment, and that's advertised on our website of the stations that are recruiting. And I would say for those that are interested in the Fire and Rescue Service, pop down to your local station, have a chat with them on their drill night and just find out what they do, find out if they're recruiting and what the levels of coverage that's needed and whether they can help and support us. But from that perspective, we aren't looking at any station closures or anything like that because we can't crew them. So we can crew our fire appliances. And what we will do is if we do see appliances that need to be available, we'll move people around to make sure that we provide that cover. We won't allow it just to sit vacant if we need it.
Talking about on-call firefighters there for the moment, we've heard from firefighters that the criteria to become an on-call firefighter is quite low compared to that of a full-time peer. Is that the case? If so, why? And does it mean that if you're an on-call firefighter, you can rise up the ranks more quickly maybe than a full-time firefighter can?
Thank you for that. So the requirements to become an on-call firefighter are the same of that as a whole-time firefighter. So the skill sets that we expect are exactly the same. And so not only can you apply to be in both shift patterns, so whole-time or an on-call firefighter, it means that if you have done on-call firefighting for a number of years and want to apply to become a whole-time firefighter, you can apply for our internal process. You don't have to then apply as you would do if you were coming fresh off the street, for example, as a member of the public. So, and the skill sets that we have for all of our firefighters are exactly the same. So the competency levels are the same, the way you get promoted is the same, and the progression is the same.
The other question that came up is that your firefighters spend quite a lot of time, quite rightly, on educating the public and on fire safety initiatives. Does that give you enough time for training for, you say you're dealing with lots of different things, you must be retraining to deal with these widespread incidents. Have you got enough time to do that?
We have. We're really pleased, actually, with what we can offer to our communities, particularly through our whole-time service. So for our on-call firefighters, there's no expectation at the moment that we would ask them to go out and do schools talks and home fire safety visits unless they really wanted to. So that we've got schemes set up for that. But for our whole-time firefighters, part of that role, part of the role map of a firefighter isn't just responding to incidents or training for incidents. It's about, as you say, going out and educating the public, whether that's through attending schools talks, delivering home fire safety visits, making sure people are safe at home, inspecting medium and high risk buildings, which have been classified now following Grenfell, supporting other buildings like hospitals and doing risk inspections against those risks. The reason for doing that is to make sure that those people that are in those premises are kept safe, but also for our firefighters to have knowledge of the risks that are prevalent within those buildings. So should there be an incident, it's also about firefighter safety. But we also build in the time for training. So we know through the productivity of our crews, there is time to do administration, what we call e-learning, so our electronic training packages, but also to be able to go out and about and do training in the communities that are being visible and also then engage with our communities on a face-to-face basis. I also feel there's probably more that we can do. And we know that through the changes within the demographics of our communities with the ageing population and the vulnerabilities that come with that, there's more that we can do with our partners through the local authorities and Blue Light partners to be able to support individuals to remain in their home longer. And there are things that we would like to do further to enhance the offering that we can.
I think a lot of people don't realise quite how easy it is to get the help and advice that they need. I mean, we did it at home. I think we bumped into some of your guys at a carnival or something like that. They took our details. We didn't really expect to hear anything more of it, but we did get a visit pretty quickly. We got some good advice. We got some help getting the right alarms. People just have to ask, don't they?
They do. So we've got a number of different ways of collecting that data. So we have a number of different ways in which it comes in, either through partners that can refer members of the community that they've come into contact with, or our crews will go out and engage with people, as you say, whether it's at carnival, pride events, whatever it might be, to spread the word around prevention and what we offer. The service that we offer is really good. So we will fit smoke detectors, we'll fit carbon monoxide detectors. We can issue things like fireproof bedding and throws for people that may smoke in the home and have risks of that way. We also offer smoke detectors and other pieces of equipment for people that might be hard of hearing or blind so that we can alert them to a fire in that case. So we do that either through the telephone number, which is through to our fire service, which is on our website, or people can go online and complete a self-assessment, which then would give them a direction to travel. So it might be that they do a self-assessment online through our toolkit, which shows that actually they're aware of their risk and they're able to manage it themselves and put a smoke detector up. It may be then that they get a full referral through to our home fire safety team and they'll be in contact with a 24-hour period to book that visit in.
We've also been told by some firefighters that in terms of the stations, I think this is they're referring to, that some of the living conditions are not the best. And I quote one firefighter who's called it atrocious. I think they were talking about Camel's Head in particular, with vermin, leaking windows, male and female firefighters sleeping in the same spaces. Are you aware of any problems of conditions in firefighter accommodation, and are there any efforts to improve them?
Yeah, certainly. So we know there's a number of our stations that we will be looking to rebuild over the next few years. We're currently looking at plans at the moment about how we do that. We've invested a lot of money into all of our stations to make sure that living conditions are appropriate and that we have separation for sleeping, accommodation and things like that. We also recognise that the age of our estate is at a point where we need to rebuild these, particularly, as you mentioned there, Camel's Head. Ever since that station has been built in the 50s or 60s, as soon as the water levels rise, it forces rodents out of the water up into areas. And we've had occasions where they have entered the fire station, and we've put measures in place to try and reduce that as far as possible. And we also will, if we see them, we'll do a deep clean and make sure that the firefighters are operating in a safe environment. Am I confident at the moment that the firefighters are working in a safe environment? Yes. If I didn't, I wouldn't allow them to do it. But do I think we can improve things? Absolutely. And we are, and we will.
the word rebuild is a big and costly one, possibly. So what's the sort of view, so to speak, of stations getting rebuilt across your patch?
So it's something through our estates plan is something we need to continue to do. So a lot of the estates, because of the way fire and rescue services were formed following the auxiliary fire service after the war, you saw what we used to have, which was a City of Plymouth Fire Brigade, would have had Exeter Fire Service, the North Devon. In 1974, it became Devon Fire and Rescue Service, and then we know in 2008 it became Devon and Somerset. But historically, those buildings were built at a time where the fire stations were needed for those city areas. We've now expanded across the counties, and we're in a period of time where we have rebuilt a number of stations over the last few years, and it's something we need to continue as we move forward. Now, we recognise the impact of COVID, which stopped everything from happening. So Camel's Head, we had plans to rebuild that a number of years ago. Because of COVID, it stopped. We're now re-looking at that again with a view to have those stations in Plymouth, or a significant investment in Plymouth around building stations that house the fire appliances that we've currently got. So whether it looks the same, whether it looks slightly different, we will be building new stations that have modern standards, that meet all the modern regulations, and it's fit for the future. We also need to look at how we do that across the rest of the service area up in Somerset, but also other areas. So we've seen fantastic new builds in Plimstock, for example, and Brixham, really fantastic fire stations, and we'll continue to do that as we move forward. And that comes back to the challenge, as I mentioned at the start, around the capital funding that we receive from the government, because we can only do that if we either borrow, and we know that interest rates are high at the moment, so borrowing isn't something we'd like to do, or we take money from our revenue budget to put into capital to be able to afford to fund those areas.
That's what I was going to ask. So how are rebuilds going to be funded? Is there a pot maybe from government you can apply to, or is it you're just going to start have to counting what money you have already and trying to divvy a bit out of it for new stations?
Yeah, so it's exactly that point at the moment. We're hoping through the comprehensive spending review from the government for this year that we may start to see direct funding for capital again. Whether we get that or not, we don't know yet, but it's something we hope that we do, and we've written to the government about. What we will be doing, though, is taking money from our revenue into our reserves to rebuild those stations. So we will commit to rebuilding fire stations to make sure that they meet modern standards, but also that they're there for our communities for community use, and they become a really vital local community resilience hub.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about workplace culture, which is all the services are feeling the same about this. I think the watchdog that oversees police forces and fire service said last year progress had been made across the county's the country's 44 services, but improvements were still required. How's Devon and Somerset doing in relation to culture, such as dealing with misconduct, making people feel that they can report grievances?
Thank you. So as you say, we've seen a number of reports that have been done across the country at different fire and rescue services. Some of that has been led by individuals raising complaints directly to media outlets or others to push for those reports. And I think that's because the lack of psychological safety for people to be able to speak up. What I have seen since I took over as a Deputy Chief Fire Officer in 2022 and then into the Chief Fire Officer role, there's a number of ways in which staff can raise concerns. One of those is directly to me. We've introduced a new scheme which is leading from the front, which is called Speak Up Guardians, and that's where we have a number of staff which other staff can go to raise concerns. That then gets raised through to me anonymously. We've invested in a confidential reporting system with an external party, and we also then have things that people can raise through grievances and whistleblowing as appropriate. What we have seen is, I think, a really good uptake of people taking the opportunity to raise concerns, and so we have been acting on that. We've been really firm in our expectations for our managers and leaders that we expect misconduct to be dealt with. We do not want to find ourselves in a position where we have an anonymous report made which leads to an external investigation for something that we're not aware of. So I will say we will always deal with things when they're raised. I want people to be able to come to work and be the best possible version of themselves. And for that, that means that 99% of our staff are fantastic people, come to work and do a brilliant job. But it's really important that they feel the sense of ability to be able to raise concerns against those that don't want to follow our values or our ethics of the Fire and Rescue Service, so that we can then support them to go and get a job elsewhere. because we need to make sure that the way we represent our communities is first class and that the trust we have for the communities remains as we move forward.
That kind of leads me into the last question, because workplaces have changed, haven't they, over the years? But you've worked within the fire service since you were 19. How much has it changed in that time in all different ways? We've talked a little bit about the environment, the different kind of shouts that you're getting, different kind of workplace. Which things are better and which things are worse?
It's interesting, really. So I come from a family of fire service. So my dad was in the fire service. My grandfather was also in the fire service. My grandfather's still with us. Unfortunately, my dad's not. But if I speak to my grandfather, who just turned 90, he used to serve in the City of Plymouth Fire Brigade many, many years ago. He will tell me about the fantastic times that they had. And at that point, they didn't go out and do community safety work. It was all responding to incidents. That's changed over time. So when I first started in the Fire and Rescue Service in 2000, we were working and going out and doing community safety activities. From that, during that period of time and the time that I've served, so 25 years, we've seen a reduction in the number of fire deaths within the home. We've seen a number of those that are killed and seriously injured on our roads. And we've seen a real change and benefit of the prevention work that we've delivered. So in that period of time, prevention has become much more prevalent in the work that we do. So it's only around about 7 to 8% of our operational time is spent dealing with incidents. The rest of it is doing other things, so around prevention and protection activities. The other things that we've seen, of course, there's been some real significant impacts within the Fire and Rescue Service during that time. So Grenfell as an outcome. We had our own fire at the Royal Clarence Hotel in Exeter. And those things, it's really important we learn from, and how we change legislation, but also about how we change our firefighters to be able to respond in a different way. We're seeing a growing demand now around lithium-ion batteries through scooters, vapes and things like that, that we are also seeing change in the profile. We had COVID, which has changed the outcome for the way that our staff work. So we have a much more flexible approach to the way that our staff work, not on fire stations because we need them to be there, but a lot of our support functions and officers can work in a different way and provide cover in a different way. And so actually, I think where we're moving towards and what I have seen is really about that empowerment, the top-down command and control structures that we've seen traditionally within the Fire and Rescue Service, which I think has led to a lot of the cultural issues that we've seen where people are frightened to speak up. They still exist on the incident ground, which is appropriate because we need to make sure that people are safe and we have a control system there. Doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to transfer into the office environment and the day-to-day working. And by allowing people to be themselves, innovation, ideas, how we save money and drive forward is going to be a lot richer in that diversity of thinking by attracting really good people to the organisation and retaining those that want to do a really, really good job. So from my perspective, I'm really proud of the service that we have. I'm sure there are cultural issues, but actually I think we're all working really, really hard to be proud of the work that we do, focusing on the people first principle to making sure we deliver absolutely fantastic standards and outcomes to our communities. We can only do that by having the best people, and it's important that they're able to be themselves. For that, they need to have a working environment which supports them in their diversity and inclusion and everything they stand for, so that we treat people as individuals but as part of a team.
Great stuff. So if you've been inspired by that at all, like you said, Mr. Ellis, it's a case of going down to your nearest fire station and seeing if you can, how you can get involved, perhaps.
Absolutely. Keep checking our website. You'll see on our social media sites as well that we're currently advertising for whole-time firefighters. We'll be doing the same again next year. Our vacancies for on-call is permanently open. I've been in the fire service for 25 years. I would not want to do anything else. I'm extremely proud of the work that we do. I'm extremely proud to lead the service that we've got. And I think that we really offer value for money to our communities. And if you want to be part of that, which I would really strongly encourage you to do, then please come down.
Great stuff. On that note, we'll say thank you very much for your time today. It's been great having you in the studio and really interesting listening to all the latest with the fire service. So thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio across the county. On the 1st of May, voters in most parts of Devon will go to the polling stations to select their county councillors, members of an authority that could well be swept aside as part of the government's ambitious plans to reorganise the country's council structures.
We've been talking to two party leaders who've paid visits to Devon in recent days. We're expecting more big guns in the county between now and polling day, and we'll catch up with them and give them airtime as and when they arrive. In the meantime, my colleague Alison Stevenson and I have been sticking microphones under the noses of Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey and Reform UK leader Nigel Farage. In chronological order of visits, it's Farage first. I started by asking him if there was any point in having these elections at all. The Devon County Council elections, is this not a scramble for cabins on the Titanic? Because Devon County Council may cease to exist.
Well, it may. You're right, but that's no argument. I mean, don't forget, there are nine counties in which the elections have been cancelled. Mm-hmm. And incredibly, people who got elected in 2021 could be serving until 2028. So I think you should be grateful that you've actually got a chance to have a vote. And it's interesting, you know, because 50 years ago, the last significant local government reorganisation, no elections were cancelled. In fact, the future shape of the counties became part of the election campaign. Personally, I have to say, I don't see how you can call it devolution, which implies power going down to a lower denominator, when actually what's being proposed is abolishing district councils and adding power up. Some counties, well, Cornwall, of course, went wholly unitary, which at least means it keeps a county identity. Many of the other counties, it looks like, will be split up into 2, 3, 4, 5. Devon wouldn't be quite as many as that, but it could be 2 or 3. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows? But 2 or 3. Well, if you do that, what is Devon? I'm open-minded in the sense that if you can persuade me that what's coming is better, then I'll listen. But if I take Cornwall as an example, you know, one of the big arguments made for these unitaries is that it'll, because you're removing tiers, it'll be more efficient and save money. Well, Cornwall's debt's about the worst in the country. So they're in a catastrophic situation. So I'm not even convinced by that. So I think that our councillors, however well or badly, or whatever we do in Devon, our councillors will be very, very sceptical about these changes unless somebody can really sit down and make an argument. It almost feels with Angela Rayner that it's sort of change for the sake of change, is the way that I see it.
So what does success look like for you on May the 2nd when they come to count the votes in Devon? What does success look like for you?
Establishing a good number of councillors elected in Devon onto the county council. I mean, this is not one of the councils we're going to win. I accept that. You know, we know the Liberal Democrats are making an absolutely gargantuan. I've got friends in South Devon. I mean, we're leaflet every blooming week going through the door. But I do think there are quite a number, significant number, of seats that have been held by the Conservatives for a long, long time. And I think what you'll see is their vote naturally be down, because 2021 was the high peak of, you know, I mean, they even won the Hartlepool by-election on that day, you know. So their vote's going to be well down. And I think what you'll see, and I've seen this in a couple of by-elections around the country in rural areas recently, where vote's naturally down. A chunk of it goes to the Lib Dems, because they're the old sort of, how can I put it, high Tory Remainer types. And a very, very big chunk of it's going to come to us.
Yeah.
And we might well pick up some, where there is a sort of residual Labour vote, we might pick up a bit. So look, I think it's going to be very interesting. I think a lot of seats, to my mind, there'll be a significant number of seats in Devon that will be three-way marginals.
Yeah.
Is there not so a tough danger, to call, really.
You get asked this question all the time, but is there not a danger that Reform splits the Conservative vote and lets the Lib Dems in a place like Devon?
There's a danger in any seat in the country that the effect of one party on the other. I think, you know, the Conservatives in charge of Devon have turned it into one of the wokest councils in the whole of the country. I can't even believe the DEI bill for the last 3 years, £500,000. Look at the money they're paying out to contractors. I mean, I can see why a county council might need short-term staff in exceptional circumstances, not £10 million a year. So, the whole thing needs a good shake-up.
When you came through the door just now, you opened with the woke thing about
it. Just struck me.
Is that something that people are talking about on the doorsteps?
Yeah, I think, do you know what? I think the whole the whole, you know, we're going to employ this person because they're black or they're this or they're that. I think people are sick of it. I think people are sick of it. I think it's a, do you know why? I think it's an insult to fair-minded people, and the vast majority of people are decent, fair-minded people. I think the idea of meritocracy over quota, I think that's a pendulum politically that's coming back at a rapid pace. Okay.
The last time I asked you some questions, you were in Brixham on your GB News show.
Yeah.
We were talking about Brexit. Fishermen were talking about Brexit. Mm. There's a feeling that they haven't had the Brexit that they voted for.
No, they haven't.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, it's awful. It's worse. Mm. I was talking to the former Brixham MP about this, Anthony, you know, who, to be fair to him, you know, did actually develop a very deep understanding of the fleet, how it was operated, the way the Marine Management Organization deal with either the individual fishermen or the crews. I would say what they're doing to particularly the under 10 metre fleet is far worse than anything that ever happened in the European Union. Absolutely shocking on a number of levels. I mean, crazy things like you've got to cover up the scuppers and put electric pumps in. Well, why endanger people's lives? And yet that's what's been happening in Brixham. You go to any under 10 metre boat, they picked up a bill for $2,000 or $3,000, which probably makes them more dangerous at sea than they were before. So, yeah. And, you know, we're currently, as we head up towards a sort of renegotiation of the so-called deal with the EU, perfectly clear that, as ever, the EU will make fish a top priority, and as ever, the British government will make it a low priority. I mean, at a minimum, what people in Brixham should have expected was 12 miles. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, I get it. You know, maybe immediately claiming a 200-mile Norwegian stuff. Maybe that would have been a bit much, a bit quick. I get that, although we should aim for it ultimately. But I think 12 was a very reasonable ask. And I think the last time I was in Brixham, which is once since I met you there, just went out of the market, because the market is fascinating. Mm. They've revolutionised fish markets.
But
and I think now you've got more French and Belgian boats on the 6 mile line than there's ever been. And I think some of the genuine environmental damage that's been caused by that is awful. So look, I am utterly hacked off.
Yeah.
With what's been delivered.
But yeah, because people are saying that Brixham is succeeding, and Brixham is succeeding.
I know, as a market,
despite
yeah.
Brexit rather than because of Brexit.
I think that's true. I think Brixham, I think what he's done with the market is it's innovative. A lot of the old, more traditional fish merchants aren't great fans of it, but, you know, change is change.
One more question. As Columbo used to say, one more question. you talked about prisons with the BBC just now. Dartmoor Prison is closed. Dartmoor Prison is not fit for purpose at the moment. Is that something, if reform were to get a foothold in the county, is that something that should happen?
So since this government came in, we've been on prisoner early release. The reoffending rates in some parts of the UK are horrific. The number of people who are tagged just simply cut the bloody things off. This is not working. Joe Public does not want early release, and nor do I. I would agree that a mark of a civilised nation is that its prisons are not uncivilised, but I wouldn't have thought it would take very much to get Dartmoor. I know it's very bleak, quite dramatic up there, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought it took very much to make Dartmoor operable again.
Reform UK leader Nigel Farage there with his opinions on the elections, the wokeness of Devon County Council, and the disappointment felt by some who voted for Brexit but didn't get what they were led to expect. Next, we hear from Ed Davey, who's been sharing a hay bale with our colleague Alison Stevenson.
Known for his campaign stunts during the run-up to last year's general election, leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey, was in North Devon last week, getting his adrenaline rush at the Big Sheep Theme and Farm Park near Biddeford. Sir Ed was joined by seven North Devon Liberal Democrat candidates hoping to retain or win seats in the Devon County Council elections, and North Devon MP Ian Room, as they enjoyed roller coaster rides and bouncing around on giant trampolines. But there was also a serious message as the Lib Dem leader called on the government to host an urgent South West tourism summit to address the impact of national insurance tax hikes and the cost of living crisis on holiday and hospitality businesses. Sitting down for a chat on a hay bale, I asked him about that and his hopes for the election.
The Big Sheep is one of these fantastic attractions that North Devon has. It's one of the things that makes North Devon such a wonderful place, alongside the beautiful countryside and the coastline and so much. And I've been hearing from the people running Big Sheep, but also other people representing hospitality and tourism across the county, about real worries stemming from two things, really. The cost of living crisis, which has meant it's more difficult for people to come, and they've seen visitor numbers go down. And then also the new tax rises of the government, particularly the employer's national insurance rise, which has really, really hit them, because the sorts of employees that it hits most are part-time employees, seasonal workers on relatively low wages. And it's almost as if Labour government's targeted the tourism and hospitality sector with this tax rise. And it's so wrong. And we've asked for an exemption. I'm afraid it's fallen on deaf ears, but we'll keep campaigning.
Obviously, you're here as well because there's a local election, Devon County Council elections. How do you think your party's going to fare?
Well, we're quite optimistic we can make some good gains. In the July election last year, we had an amazing result, one of our best results for decades. And with the Liberal Democrats winning 72 MPs, our best result for over 100 years, we feel there's some momentum behind it and a lot of support coming our way. And I've been talking to some of our candidates who've been knocking on doors, really campaigning hard. They tend to be people from the community, you know, and who've been active in the community already. And they're saying they're getting a really warm reception, that lots of lifelong Conservatives are switching to the Liberal Democrats, and Labour voters have been very disappointed by the Labour government, so are switching to us too. So there's a sense that people like what they're seeing, local people wanting to fix local issues. And issues that are being raised with our candidates, very varied actually. A lot of people raising the potholes in Devon. Road maintenance seems to be a massive problem. Some people raising issues around health and social care, lack of dentists. And social care is really important for the council's finances, which haven't been run very well, I'm afraid, under the Conservatives. All councils are strapped, let's be clear. So it's not just Devon. But Devon seems one of the worst, with its massive debts that they've run up in the last 4 years. So the next administration is going to have a tough time sorting it out. But I think if you listen to people, listen to the community, make sure you're focusing on their priorities, you can sort it out. And Liberal Democrats are very committed to that. And one of the things we will want to do is look at social care, adult social care, which is a massive part of the budget. So over 50% of the budget. And nationally, we've been arguing for a much more bold policy on social care from the national government. The Conservatives didn't deliver that. Labour's put it on hold a little bit. They've said they're setting up this commission on social care, but it's not going to report for 3 years. And I don't think elderly people who need these services, disabled people, can wait that long. And councils are going to be very stretched. So we'll be campaigning both in the county and nationally to try to sort out social care.
A local government reorganisation is coming up. Devon County won't be around very long. Do you think anyone's really worried about what happens at Devon County?
I think the people of Devon are. I think they felt that both national government and local governments let them down. And one thing we are picking up is a lack of trust in politics more broadly. I just think people want politicians to get things done, to listen to them, be active in their community and try to sort out, you know, basic problems. And I'm afraid too many politicians have been focusing on their own issues and not really listening to the basics and getting the basics done.
Isn't it a fact that politics just gets in the way of everything, though?
Not necessarily. I've seen politics work really well in places where you have local community champions. And, you know, I'm very proud that we've got that reputation. And you don't need to take my word for it, but the leader of the Conservatives, Kemi Badenoch, said in a recent interview that Liberal Democrats are the sort of people who fix church roofs and people in the community like them. That's what she said. I think she meant it as an insult, but I'm wearing it as a badge of honour. I'm proud that we get things done and we fix stuff. I'm very practical sort of people. Now, we haven't got a magic wand to wish away all the problems, but we'll roll up our sleeves and try our very best to work for the people of Devon. And you talk about the reorganisation. I don't know where that's going to end. What I am alarmed at is that central government now seems to be imposing things on communities, not engaging with them. And I think that's wrong. I think people should have more a say in how they are governed, rather than a new government coming on Whitehall and tearing everything up without any real proper consultation with local communities. So we'll see how that goes, and we'll try in Parliament to speak up for people in Devon, Cornwall, across the southwest.
In Devon, at the general election, Lib Dems won 6 seats off the Tories. In Devon County Council, there's 38 Conservatives, and there's 9 Liberal Democrats. You've got a long way to go, but do you think the general election is maybe a precursor for something that could happen here for you?
Well, we're optimistic we can take gains from the Conservatives. I think people know across Devon that if they want to get rid of the Conservatives, they need to vote Liberal Democrat. We're the strongest alternative. We showed that the general election by a long way. And so people, I think people who were thinking about Labour are pretty upset by Labour. So as I say, I think we have a good chance of making gains. You know, it is a big mountain to climb to take overall control, but we're working hard and we're optimistic that we are seeing quite big swings to the Liberal Democrats here. And I'm really grateful for the very kind and warm reception people have given our canvassers and our candidates. One thing that we keep getting told is that we're the only Poddens who do anything. I've talked to a number of candidates in Devon who say, well, you're the only ones who actually knock on our door. You're the only ones who put leaflets. You're the only ones who are raising issues. And I mean, that's probably a bit of a sad indictment for the other parties, from, you know, Conservatives to Reform to Labour. But I'm proud that's the way we campaign. I think that's what you should do.
I just wanted to ask you about the hospital. I know that you visited the North Devon District Hospital last year. Is that something that's still a key priority for you? I know that the community down here is still waiting for a minister's visit. Is that something you're still pressing for?
Yeah, I mean, when I went around North Devon District Hospital with Ian Room, the MP now for North Devon, I was genuinely shocked to see the state of some of the buildings there and to hear from some of the doctors, as well as the managers, that they're under such strain. They show me the operating theatres, four operating theatres when their numbers need 12. So they haven't got anywhere near enough operating theatres. And they were worried that some of their operating theatres they've got now, you know, need a bit more modernisation and improvement. And Ian, since he's been elected, has raised the issue of North Devon Hospital multiple times. He keeps getting questions of the Prime Minister and keeps raising it with the Prime Minister. And he's pushing for a ministerial visit. And I hope we'll get one, because certainly you couldn't fault Ian for his tireless championing of the case for investment in North Devon District Hospital. What really struck me was the geography, because it looks to me like it's the most remote hospital in the country, and that means that people have to travel a long way. It means that getting staff can be an issue. So if we don't get that investment soon, it could really undermine the whole health service in North Devon and North Cornwall, because a lot of people in North Cornwall use the hospital, of course. So, Ian's making a strong case, and it really is vital that government ministers come and look for themselves. I think if they come and visit, see for themselves, they will realise the case for major investment to modernise and rebuild North Devon District Hospital is overwhelming. I think it must be one of the strongest in the country. Certainly the strongest, one of the strongest I've ever seen.
Sir Ed Davey there talking to me at the Big Sheep near Biddeford during a visit to the South West ahead of next week's Devon County Council elections.
In the interests of fairness, there's a full list of every candidate, of every party, for every seat in the county, all 60 of them, on the Radio X website.
Well, it was very insightful listening to those two leaders, I think, and I love Nigel Farage's description of Devon County Council as woke. I think they might sort of be quite proud of that in a way. It makes them sound trendy almost, but I'm not sure I've heard them described as that before.
Well, that was his opening thing. As soon as he came in through the door at Sandy Park to meet the candidates, that was the first thing that he launched into was the wokeness of Devon County Council. So it's obviously something that he'd been thinking about. This is the angle I'm going to take in Devon. I'm not sure that's an issue that comes up on the doorsteps, but I don't know. Who am I to say?
I guess we will see whether that sort of political titan, as he may well be called by some people, how his party fares, in Devon in little over a week. Anyway, that's Devoncast, your weekly podcast rounding up all the county's crucial stories and talking to the people behind those stories. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening, and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.